Opposes nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. Thank you.
Please join me in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. And Justin will read the steps.
My name is Justin. This is the best day of my life, and I'm an alcoholic. 1, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. 2, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6, we're entirely ready to have God remove these key defects of character. 7, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all the persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for the knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. And 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all of our affairs.
Now Elise will read the traditions.
Hi, I'm Elise. I'm an alcoholic. Hi, the 12 traditions. 1, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. 2, for our group purpose, there has been one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. 3, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. 4, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and film. 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
Thank you. The format of the meeting is 2 10-minute speakers followed by our information break, and then our main speaker, who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Brooke.
My name is Brooke Pridemore, and I am an alcoholic. Scott M., AG, steps 9 through 12, June 18th, 2010. Thank you, parents. It's an honor. I drank a lot. That's the middle and the end. In the beginning, though, I was kind of always out of step. I'm from Detroit, Michigan, born and raised. I never really had the same group of friends for very long. I got in a fist fight on my first day of kindergarten. When I was 12 years old, I was playing a video game, and I got so frustrated with the level of difficulty that I had reached that I punched out my TV screen. Like, bam! You know, don't you know who I am, Nintendo? Things never quite fit, you know? So the day after we graduated high school, this kid pulled the bottle out of his bag and he took a sip and this light bulb went off over my head. I had always shied away from alcohol. It was never really in the house. My parents, when they drank, would throw up all the next day. But this day, for whatever reason, the light bulb went off over my head, and I went, give me that bottle. I took it from him, and I drained 3 inches off it right off the top. Put the top back on and threw it back at him. And he went, yo, Pridemore, I didn't know you drank. And I went, I don't. And we both laughed hysterically. I felt this warmth coming over me that I had not felt before. I felt this comfort. I didn't like this guy. But suddenly I liked him because he had this thing that made it all a little easier. The next 13 and a half years, almost 13 years exactly, I would say, were just like that. I was either completely in the bag and comfortable with the people that I was around, if there was anybody around that I didn't care if there was, or I was clawing my eyeballs out trying not to drink. I don't have any really funny stories. In just trying to go over the whole catalog, I was thinking about it, and like one night in like 2001, I'm sitting in a crowded bar on a Saturday night crying, ordering 2 car bombs at a time and doing them by myself. Like, that's as like entertaining as my story gets. Like, nothing fun happened. I hear people say things like they became, you know, like James Bond or like somebody cool that everybody wanted to be around. I was always more like the character Frank Booth in the movie Blue Velvet. Do you know, that's the Dennis Hopper character. If I'm in the right mood, I'm having a good time, but you don't want to be anywhere near me. So as time went on, I still didn't have any friends. I'm a musician, a quasi-professional musician. I started to tour in about 2004, and touring was great. It didn't matter even if anybody came to the show, because even if there was one other guy, it was a party that I didn't have to be worried about the next day. So just in the car and off to the next party and off to the next party. Till about 2007, and the wheels just kind of came off. I had just broken up with my girlfriend. I had girlfriends over the years. I never really noticed them. They were kind of just there. They would stick around until I left for some reason. But I broke up with this one girl, and I hit a wall. And I got so drunk one night that I woke up, when I got home from wherever I was, I prayed that I would wake up from going to sleep. That's like how messed up I was. And when I woke up 8 hours later, I said, well, I got down on my knees and prayed. I guess I'd better do this. But AA wasn't for me. You know, the disease, the voice in my head said, this is not for you, this whole going to church thing. And so I convinced myself to enter, excuse me, what I called the marijuana maintenance program. I did that for 2 years. I told people that I was sober. I counted days doing it. I had anniversary parties. At the end of the second year, this substance had killed my appetite to such a point that I was about 35 pounds lighter than I am now. I was impotent, shaking uncontrollably, kind of like I am right now. And just a complete wreck. And it became apparent that I shouldn't be taking this substance anymore. And I put the pipe down, and the little voice in my head that told me to do that in the first place said, you know, man, like, you can have a glass of scotch. Like, it's cool. You were just sober for 2 years. Like, you don't have a problem. And the same day that I put the one substance down, I picked up the booze again. And it was like, the disease had been hiding in a closet, just hitting a punching bag for 2 years, waiting for that to happen. Because in not very much time, I was just a complete wreck again. I had busted up with another girl. I put myself on tour for 6 months to forget about her and to forget about some other things. And at the end of that time, I was completely drunk, completely broke. I hadn't forgot about her. I hadn't worked out the other things. And I was sitting there, it was my first night back, and I just looked at my life, and I had this prescribed substance in my pocket, and I said, well, we're going to check out tonight. We're going to get as drunk as we possibly can, and we're going to take this other thing, and that's going to be it. Like, hit the game over button and just check out. Like, I was going to wake up dead on my friend's couch. I didn't care. And when I woke up the next afternoon, I had a full can of Coors in front of me, and I reached into my pocket, and the substance was still there. And I looked at that as though it were an act of God and sort of a sign. The little voice in my head this time said, you know, that just happened. Your 20s are gone. Tomorrow you're not even 30 anymore. Like, when are you going to realize that your way isn't going to work? And I called a friend who a couple months before I had advised to come into this program, and she had found her way in my wiseness with, you know, a beer in each hand and said, yeah, maybe you are an alcoholic. And she brought me, it was a Thursday night, she brought me to the Atlantic Group Beginners Meeting, and she warned me that it was kind of weird, that it wasn't like, you know, the places I might have checked out before, like they were a little uptight, I think was the word she said. And we went into this room and sat down, and as we sat down, she said, oh, God, I forgot. Like, this is the meeting you have to stand up and say you're an alcoholic and you have one day in. And I about jumped out of my skin, but I had made my way into the room, and so it came around to me, and I stood up and said, hi, my name is Brooke, I'm an alcoholic, I have one day. And I had just been on tour for 6 months, and I did not hear in that whole 6 months cumulatively the applause that I heard in that room that night. I stood up, I got up to get my one-day coin, and Adam D. Had been the guest speaker that night, and he had said, I had walked in as he was saying, and Adam, imitation is the sincerest form of flattery, he said, yo, I don't care if you get 80 years in this program, this one-day coin is the most important coin you're ever going to get. And I got up there to get my one-day coin, and this guy that doesn't know me from a hole in the wall hands his one-day coin over to me. And so I'm losing it, because then if I go back out there, I've got this guy's most important coin he's ever got, so I had to stay. There was a swarm of guys after the meeting was over. There were about 25 of them. I don't remember any of their names because I was terrified. If you've seen the movie Finding Nemo, it's like the scene where the fish are on the rocks and all the seagulls are going, mine, mine, you know, like it's not... It was not an easy thing to deal with, and I was running out the door and getting out of there, and this guy that like looked kind of calmer than them said, hey, let's go get something to eat, and eating was a good idea. I hadn't eaten that day. So I went out to eat with this guy. His name's Scott. By the end of the night, I have a sponsor. I have a reason to come back to this room. I have somebody to account to every day. Over the months, I started diligently working the steps. The book calls for an immediate and rigorous course of action, and I firmly, firmly believe that that's the way to do it. I was working the fourth step by like 85 days. It was terrible, terrible pain, but in less than 2 months, it was over because I jumped right into it. And by 7 months in, I was through the steps and willing and ready to take on guys. And I didn't feel any different, But then, I did kind of feel different because I didn't want to die anymore. And just a couple of months ago, I was at the Thursday meeting, and this guy overheard me say, well, when I'm feeling bad and about to give some piece of advice, and he went, dude, you feel bad? I don't believe this works if you feel bad. And if I fooled even one person into believing that I'm happy, have I really fooled him, or has this program worked for me? Thanks.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Carrie May.
Hi, I'm Carrie May. I'm an alcoholic. So my sobriety date is May 31st, 2002. Liz L. is my sponsor. Atlantic Group has been my home group since December of 2009, and I'm working steps 9, 10, 11, and 12. So I've never spoken in front of this many people before. But this meeting literally has saved my life. I've just come every week, and I have commitments at multiple meetings, and I come every week. And I just feel like this is the medicine. Like, hearing the truth and the stories in this room has totally saved me. I was hurting and really dry. I loved Brooke's story. It's very different than mine. So if you're brand new here, just keep coming to meetings, because eventually you'll hear your own story, but mine's quite different. I was spent a lot of years not finding the solution, like to get it on the first day and get right into the book, and doing your fourth step is amazing. So where to start? 36 years and 10 minutes is really hard to do. And okay, so When I first time I ever drank, I was 16. I blacked out. I ended up in my underwear, just, you know, puke everywhere, that kind of scene. And from there, I partied a lot in high school, and I hit a bottom. I did a lot of other substances really young, and traveled to Tyler, Texas, and like was living in the Bible Belt for a summer, and like did a lot of drugs. Came back, and within a few months, I did one semester of college. I grew up in Ohio. I was born in West Virginia. Grew up in Ohio, and then from there, I spent the summer in Texas, and I came back, and I just crashed, and I went to rehab out in Arizona, and it saved my life. Like, I was not capable of asking for help at that point. I was just a mess, and so I know that it saved my life. I had OD'd and passed out and ended up with, you know, wrong places with funky people, and somehow, like, I just survived, like, near misses. And so I went to rehab in Arizona, and I've actually now been sober longer than, or like I've been sober more time than I drank, which is kind of amazing when I was, you know, looking at the whole story the last couple of days. So I grew up in AA, really. But I stayed sober from age 19 to 21, and then I never had a legal drink, and I was like, what's this? You know, I was sent to rehab, and I didn't quite do it for me. And so I was dating somebody, and I decided, you know, I'm going to drink. And so I decided to drink. And so for 5 years, I sat at the coffee shop. I remember the day, and I told my sponsor, like, I don't want to be sober anymore. I loved the fellowship. I loved the fellowship and the meetings, but I didn't quite get it. Like, in the big book, it says you need to concede to your innermost self that you're alcoholic, and I just never did that. And so so I drank for 5 years, and then I hit more of a spiritual bottom when I was 27. I just had been searching. And a huge part of my story too is just this restlessness inside of me, like really hard for me to be still, like moving all over the place, changing jobs, changing homes, changing relationships. And so when I was living in Arizona and I ended up hitting a spiritual bottom, I ended up living right next door to a building that had a 7 a.m. Meeting called the Crazy Birds. So I went over there and I, you know, saw my sponsor, and she sat me down and we worked the steps again, and things got a little bit better. I feel like through the fellowship again and through working the steps, I feel like it's a program like of continuous action. And so like if you stop doing the daily things, then I feel like I just kind of slid backwards, and things got really dramatic, and I put a relationship ahead of this program. And so that created a lot of moving around again. And then I ended up applying to grad school and moving to New York City about 4 years ago. And when I arrived in New York City, I went to about 2 meetings a week, didn't have a sponsor, didn't do the steps, and did a lot of meditation, which the meditation is beautiful, but I think I've said this before, you have to be normal before you can be super normal. So there was a part of me that loved meditating, but I was just emotionally just, I couldn't find my ground. And for years, and so then I hit this bottom, and I didn't have a place to live. Like, I had just graduated. I made it through the program after 2 years, which is somehow amazing. And then I didn't have the willingness to get a job. I was terrified, and my fear just really paralyzed me. And so So an AA friend let me crash in their living room, and I basically didn't have a job or a home, and I was just like totally desperate. And they talk about the gift of desperation, that like every AA needs to hit bottom. And so I was dry, I didn't have a program, and this friend said, why don't you call this woman who's had a psychic change? I drank with her like 15 years ago in Boston, and she's a different person. So I called Liz, and we met and had the willing to go to any lengths talk. Are you willing to go to any lengths for your sobriety and do things that you don't understand or agree with? And at that point, I mean, I think it's truly a gift. Like, when you feel like dying, it's like die or change. So at that point, I hadn't drank, and I didn't want to drink, but I didn't want to live. So I said, okay, I'm willing to do something differently. So the suggestions were to go to 90 meetings in 90 days, get a commitment in each of the meetings, and not each of those 90 meetings, sorry, that sounds extreme, but go to two meetings a week and get a commitment at them. And actually, I was just talking with my sponsor over the weekend about this idea, like almost, I have 9 years and a few months, so almost going on 10 years, why am I still calling my sponsor every single day? And why do we do that? And it was that what was told to me is that it's a daily act of surrender, because like I always think I have these impulsive ideas, and like this sounds like such a great idea, why don't I go call this person or do this? And it's not usually ever a good idea. So now I run it by her. So a sponsor is somebody that I talk to every day, and I run by these impulsive thoughts that I have and ideas. And I actually feel more freedom right now than I've ever felt in my whole life, because I used to move, do all these things very quickly, and I didn't have stillness, and I didn't have a sense of peace inside. And I feel like a psychic change is where I have more faith than I do fear most days. It's still not perfect, but that's a progress, not perfection. So there's lots of people in this room I really care about, and I feel like what's different this time around is that I have women that I'm working with. They call me every day, just like I call my sponsor every day. And going through the big book has just been really, really powerful. And it's talking about a spiritual solution. And so for me, my spiritual solution is meditating in the morning and asking for help, just being willing to ask for help. And I listen to lots of speaker tapes on the subway. If somebody's here sharing and I really like them, I'll buy the CD. And it's like this spiritual nourishment that I'm always like putting inside of me, because I feel like I had this part of me that was just always grasping. And Liz likes to say that my disease is the death grip, and that my higher power is multiplication and expansion. And so when I'm in a hard place, man, everything gets really small and really dark. And then I come to a meeting or I listen to a speaker tape, and it's like, move a muscle, change a thought. Like, I just feel like everything I've learned about how to live my life is through the wisdom in these rooms and through these tapes and through you all, really. And so my life today is very different. It was just a huge adjustment to New York City. I mean, I was a woman of extremes. Like, at one point, I totally shaved my head big bald, thinking I'd get rid of my ego. Like, I went to ashrams. I was doing all this stuff, like, sober and not sober, like, searching. And, like, you know, doing performance art, doing all this, painting myself bright red, and just doing, like, crazy things. But, like, none of that worked. Like, it just didn't do what, it didn't like sink deep enough inside of me. And I feel like the message here is like, it's really simple. Like, one alcoholic speaking to another. It's like the language of the heart. Like, I can sit with a sponsee I can literally see an aha moment happen where we're like, okay, this is the solution. And it's so simple. It's not easy, but like, I feel like everybody in this room, if you made it here, it's a miracle, because there's so many people. Like, I have family members, and you know, I feel like the further away I got from the program, it's almost like the less scared of the disease I was. I hung out with people that used, and I didn't think it was a big deal. And then I come here, and I just see like the thin line of like the chance that we have. Like, if you're here, it's kind of amazing. And like, a lot of people don't make it, and it's kind of hard to see that, but it's true. Okay, thank you all. It's just amazing to be speaking tonight. It was a little terrifying, but it's beautiful. So I want to just end with this. I listened to Chuck C the other day on the train, and he said that conscious separation is the problem and conscious unity is the answer. So just, you know, grab somebody after the meeting and talk to them. Okay, thank you.